Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. And I'm going to be reviewing a book which I finished quite a while ago, back in December, like mid-December I finished this book, or well, maybe a bit after mid-December, but probably like 3.5-4 weeks ago I finished this book. So if this review is slightly more rambling or slightly less focused than it could have been, all I have are some notes that I made as I was listening to the audiobook, and some of those are a little bit cryptic, I must admit, even for myself 3.5 weeks later or 4 weeks later. The reason why I didn't get onto this review straight away is that I came home and then it was Christmas and etc, etc, etc. Lots of projects going on, lots of holiday things, New Year's, and working on other projects at the moment as well. And I was reading other novels and reviewing other things, like I did 5 podcasts with Juliana since my last solo podcast as well. Another one of the main reasons I didn't get to the podcast straight away was that it's quite an average book. And if a book is really, really good, like I really, really enjoy, I will get on and want to do the review straight away. I want to talk about this, I want to talk about that, or maybe I'll think about it for a few days and kind of confirm in my brain what I actually liked about the book and then do the podcast. And if a book is really, really bad, that, again, is another great excuse to say a lot or think that I've got a lot to say because I want to really rip into the book. Maybe I don't want to rip into a book, but, you know, sometimes there's an opportunity. And that can also be quite fun. And I'll discuss what I really hated about the book with Juliana or whoever I'm with and just talk about it. With this one, On the Steel Breeze by Alistair Reynolds, kind of like an average book, and I'm not really motivated to discuss it in detail because it didn't really grab me in the ways that I would want from an Alistair Reynolds book. So this was published last year. It's the follow-up to Blue Remembered Earth, which came out the year before that. Alistair Reynolds is pretty good that he puts out one book every year. I think it's actually part of his book deal that he got. I think he got like this 10-year, 10-book deal with Golance for like a few million pounds or whatever it was. They're coming out of the book factory that is Alistair Reynolds. And I think in a way, this book kind of reflects that. I think if he'd have spent a bit more time on it, I'm not really sure. I don't want to criticize, hey, you should spend more time on the books, but it did feel like it was too long, and it kind of just felt like a replay of some of his previous ideas put together in new ways, in interesting ways. There's a lot of stuff going on in here, but yeah. So let me just set it up. So Blue Remembered Earth follows the story of the Akinya family, and the Akinyas were a trade and science family, you know, like a family dynasty set in Tanzania, and so they used the Mount Kilimanjaro as a launch thing, so they would shoot things up into space, and they controlled the launching into space of stuff. And they were very, very rich and very influential. And then the next generation was in charge of this and in charge of that. So we got down into the grandparents of Eunice Akinya, who was like the main matriarch of that tribe. Let me put it, well, maybe not tribe, I'm trying to say like, what you have matriarchs and elephant packs, herds. In the herd of Akinyas, Eunice was the matriarch, and she disappeared and left some clues around the place to try and track her down and track this down and track that down. And Blue Remembered Earth was her grandchildren going along and trying to find what she had done or what she was thinking. And one of the thing that really summed up the book for me was the quote which one of the characters did. It was just like, well, why couldn't she have put the last clue in the same place that she put the first clue? And then we could have just got the answers right at the beginning, because otherwise, while I enjoyed a lot of the stuff in Blue Remembered Earth in the kind of like near future. Well, it's not near future. It's set a few hundred, maybe 100 years or something in the future. But it's quite a utopian, very optimistic future. And also it was like a grand tour novel, which is, you know, like some of the action happens on Earth and some of it happens on the moon and some of it happens under the sea and some of it happens on Phobos and some of it happens on Mars and some of it happens on Saturn, maybe Saturn in this book anyway, that I'm going to review. So they go around to all the, oh, Venus maybe? No, Venus was in this book as well. Anyway, so visit lots of different places. Alistair Reynolds gets to describe lots of spaceships and aeroplanes and technology and cloning and artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff. So at the end of this, at the end of Blue Remembered Earth, a new spaceship, like space drive technology, is invented. So we join the story of the Echinias. Another few hundred years into the future, life extension technology is coming on. We're now following the next generation after Blue Remembered Earth. And we follow, most specifically, let me just get my notes out here, Chico Echinia. And we don't just follow her once, we follow her three times. Now, this is a little bit confusing to get your head around for me just to explain it. But at the very beginning of the book, it's a really good opening of this book. So Chico meets up with someone who then tells Chico what happened to her parents and her grandparents and her great-grandparents' generation. It's like, and you did this, and then the Echinias did this, and the Echinias did that. It's very handy because, you know, I'd not read the previous book for like a year and a half. And it was very, very handy to have all of those details filled in. I was like, oh, yeah, now I remember. Oh, yeah, and there was Eunice over here. Oh, yeah, and they went here and there. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Really good beginning. But then, like, the question arises, and I understand the question that Alistair Reynolds is trying to ask here about space opera. Like, how does space opera, interstellar space opera, how does that work if the speed of light can't be broken? That was my little question that I made a note of. And it's very difficult. Either you have to put everyone in cold sleep, or they have to spend, you know, generations traveling between the stars. And so one character, it takes them, you know, lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes to get anywhere. But if you want to get one character to go lots of different places, what you can do is clone the characters and send them to lots of different places and then get them back together again and then let them share their memories. So you can actually have the same character in three different places or four different places, or in the case of House of Suns, where there's like 1,000, I think there's like 1,000 of them, or and they split apart and tour around the galaxy for 10,000 years and have a place, a grand meeting every, you know, 10,000 years, and they all get back together again. And they're spending a lot of time in cold sleep in between, but generally the idea is that you have the same character getting back together and sharing information and getting all that kind of stuff. So that's House of Suns, that's one way to do it. But in House of Suns, all of the characters, when they split apart, and there's 1,000 of them, each one of them has a different accent, each one of them, some of them are male, some of them are female, even if they're clones of the same person. So they've got very different and distinct characters. Now, what we have here is on the Steel Breeze is just one person, Chico, and she splits herself into three people in a technology way that is very interesting, but I'm not going to explain it now. But even she doesn't know which one of her three aspects is the original. None of them know which one is the original. They go by the names of Chico Red and Chico Yellow and Chico Green. And the idea being that one of them, because Chico has got a lot to do and she's got lots of responsibilities, but Chico Red goes out to try and find her grandmother, who at the end of Blue Remembered Earth left the solar system in a new ship with new spaceship technology, like I mentioned before. So Chico Red goes to find Eunice Echinia and disappears off in that direction. Chico Yellow stays at home on Earth, and she's like the control of it. She's just the one who will always be in the same place. So when Chico Red gets back, or when Chico Green gets back and or sends their memories, transmits their memories back, she's always there. She's like the one who can like coordinate between them. So she's like the base station. And Chico Green is set onto a generational holoship, which is being is heading towards a place called Crucible. And Crucible is a place where they've spotted some big alien artifacts, some big unexplained alien technology sitting there on the planet of Crucible. They make this big, like, solar system-wide radio telescope or visual telescope to check out, hey, what's going on in this planet over there? Ah, look at what we found. Really good. And which has quite a bit of plot stuff tied up with that as well. So what you actually do is have the same character who is sometimes on Earth, and we meet her at Earth, and she has been sent the memories from Chico Green. So Chico Yellow at home has been sent the memories from Chico Green, but she's kind of like rebelled against her own previous selves and says, no, I'm not going to accept these memories, and I can't accept these memories, and there's no way for me to do it. And then the key to those memories is lost, and they can't work out what's going on. And then in a way, she suddenly goes, okay, now the problems are solved, and she gets those memories. And then what happens is that it suddenly skips to Chico Green's point of view, and we get what she's been doing recently on the holoship heading to Crucible, even though these are 20-year-old memories, because the speed of light means that these memories are 20 years old. So then we skip back 20 years and see what's been going on. And then at the end of those memories, Chico Green sends her memories again from the holoship back to... at the end of those memories, yeah, it catches up with Chico Yellow, and Yellow then sends her memories off to Chico Green in the holoship that's heading to Crucible, and then at the end of that, it's sent back. So what we do, we have this exchange of memories going backwards and forwards, and we keep, you know, one of them will go into cold sleep, and the other one will just, you know, just hang out for a while and get over what's going on and watch trees grow or whatever you do when you're a very long-lived person on Earth. And look after the sun, and then Chico Red turns up again later on as well. So you get this thing, and it's weird that the plot moves at the speed that it takes to send memories between two people across interstellar space, which sounds like a really clever idea, and I think it is a very clever idea, and I think that if the basic story was a stronger story, it could have been. It's put it this way: it's a plot device or a plot mechanic or a novel writing structure, which I actually really appreciate and I find very interesting. I mean, if you've read my own science fiction, the Minding Tomorrow series, I do something similar as someone is receiving memories from themselves. So you know, you get that same kind of thing of memories being delivered between two people who are theoretically the same person, or they have the same brain structure, theoretically, but then each time it happens, it changes them a bit, and they get new outlooks on life, and they see problems in different ways because they're getting this influence. But then that kind of same thing spread out over, you know, 40 years, 60 years, and then 80 years later, and it takes longer and longer to get between the holoships each time. The problem, though, is that the plot is kind of snagged with this. It's like Alistair Reynolds has this idea, this would be good. But then the story he tells, it kind of exploits that to a fault. Like, at the end of you think, this is really great. And up until about halfway through the book, I was like, this is really good. There's lots of really good action. They've got to do interesting stuff. There's this artificial intelligence who's trying to stop them, but they're trying to get here. And then this is happening, that's happening. And then halfway through the book, there's suddenly this big gap. And it's sort of like, and now, 40 years later, they do this. And then there's another big gap. And it's now even longer. And surprisingly, for an Alistair Reynolds novel, the plot gets slower and slower as you reach the end of the book, until the point where I'm thinking, well, by the time that this character gets there, that character's already going to be away, and it's going to take 40 years for by light speed to get the memories back across here. And it feels like there's like a divergence between these two characters, or the three characters, of Chico Green and Chico Yellow, being the main two that we're following in this book. I was thinking, well, doesn't that need to be updated? But by the time that's going to happen, all of this stuff over here, which is happening, which is really important. So, unfortunately, I don't think the plot can stand up to the central conceit and the central structure, ideal of this novel, which is a real pity. So, the stuff that happens on Earth is interesting, because I really like the fact that Blue Remembered Earth was a very not a utopian novel, but there was an optimism to the future, which I really enjoyed and really appreciated, and I think more science fiction could learn from that. However, it did kind of make the story, like the crisis in the story and the drama there, be kind of at a level where you think, well, why didn't they just why didn't they just do this, or why didn't they just do that? Why should this thing be kept secret? It felt like artificially imposed tension on the story. And it did feel like that bit here as well, because there's some stuff which is going on, and for our characters, we know what's important, we know what's going on. But it's kind of kept secret from the rest of the world, and the rest of the world is like, yay, happy, happy, and they think, oh, it could be like the culture in a few years' time, you know, that you got the protectors, which are these robots which look after people and make sure everybody's safe all the time, and you get the providers, and the providers are these robots which build things for people, and it's like, the providers will build this for us. Look, and we have a city over here. It's just been built for us. Oh, that's really great. And there's people living under the sea, and there's people living on the moon, and there was, in the previous book, Blue Remembered Earth was the de-scrutinized zone, which is like a private area which you are not in control, or you're not being controlled, or nothing is being controlled by this artificial intelligence and these overseeing computers. But in this book, suddenly that's being taken away. There are no de-scrutinized zones anymore and other things going on. And the people under the sea are like, oh, we don't want this. We're a bit afraid of this. And you're kind of like, oh, well, what's going on? Is this going to be Skynet or is this going to be, you know, what's going to happen here? And all of those kind of, all that kind of stuff is happening on Earth. I said I wasn't going to mention what's happening on Earth, but that's the kind of stuff that's going down. And however, back on the spaceship with Chico Green, Chico Green is heading off on this holoship. That's where most of the drama or most of the like real storyline is happening. And this, it feels like I've mentioned before. We've got bits of like Watching Trees Grow in this book by Alice Reynolds. We've got a bit of the. Watching Trees Grow isn't by Alice Reynolds, isn't it? That's by Peter F. Hamilton. But anyway, there's other science fiction that this reminds me of by Alistair Reynolds. We've definitely got aspects from Pushing Ice, which unfortunately, because that is one of my, I think that's kind of minor Alistair Reynolds, and you've got this political maneuvering going on a ship which is heading through space in a closed environment and, you know, different leaders swapping places and this person's then in charge and this politics in charge. And I don't understand sometimes with Alistair Reynolds' politics that, or his view of politics, that once somebody is in charge, it's just presumed that they're in charge all the time. Like a captain of the ship is then just presumed to be in charge. But, like, when you're in an isolated system, shouldn't it be run more like a democracy? Or maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe someone should be in charge. But it feels like the people who get put in charge, it's something like, well, maybe this person will be in charge. Oh, and this person's very political and they're very doing this. Oh, that person gets in charge. But then that person gets kicked out and now this person's in charge. And it seems to just be like going from stasis to stasis, or like a presumption of power and control to the next presumption of power and control. And everyone just goes along with it until one person goes, well, I think I should be in control now. Oh, this is going to happen in control now. So there's that going on. We also have something which is very much like the sections in Chasm City, where you've got not just one ship going to another planet, you've got a caravan of ships going to another planet, and there's like intense rivalry between those, between the different ships, and some of them are sending stuff over here, and then one of them blows up, and there's an accident on another one, and these other ones are imposing this on these other people, and sanctions on this, and there's supposed to be trade in between them. So that felt a bit like Pushing Ice. Another thing which it stands out, or which I made a note of in the notes when I was reading it, it's sort of like, oh, and they're taking elephants into space. It's very well known. It really pretty much starts off that they look after elephants. There's a big connection with elephants and the Akinya family in the previous book, and here that the elephants theme continues. Not just normal elephants, but also genetically manipulated uplifting elephants. The uplifted elephants are not that far along on the uplift way, but it's going on in the same way, actually, that in Chasm City they take the dolphins along. Here they take the elephants along for some hopefully future uplifted non-human intelligence companion species for the humans on their new planet. Maybe. I guess that's the idea. But you're taking along the elephants. What else have I got here in my notes? Oh yeah, the most important part, the most like the big crisis on this on these ships that are heading there. It's like, ah, we want to get there, and it's going to take us like 250 years, or however. I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it's going to take us 250 years to get there in our generation ships. So a lot of us will be in cold sleep, and we've got these big engines with this new alien mathematics derived technology powering us along. And it'll take us 250 years to get there. But at the beginning of the journey, they decided, well, we're still developing these engines, but we're setting off now. So by the time we get going, we know there's going to be some post-Chibaza technology, the PC post-Chibaza mathematics, whatever it is. There's a field of mathematics, and they know that they can get more out of it. They know that once they set off, the engines are going to be way more powerful, and they're going to be able to get way more energy out of it in the future. That's what the mathematics and the physics, all everyone says. So they're like, well, instead of us getting there in 250 years, how about we just crank the engines up and see if we can accelerate up to the point, and then while we're on the way, we will discover how to make these new engines and refit the engines and make them more efficient, and then we can just slow down at the other end using less fuel. So theoretically, all these ships should have taken up 50% of the fuel to accelerate up to speed to go, and then on the other end, they should use 50% of the fuel to slow down and stop again at the other end. But in a burst of optimism at the beginning, they said, well, let's just burn off like 80% of the fuel, get there quick, and then just use 20% of the fuel to slow down the other end. And we will just rely on us having better technology. And I was reading this, I was listening to this, the audiobook, thinking, really? Really, is that what people would do? Like a whole fleet would just go, well, we'll just have to rely that in 150 years' time or in 120 years' time, technology and science will have moved on. And I can kind of understand that approach in some projects. I mean, it feels a bit like, hey, well, what we can do is just keep, like, as an analogy, it's like, well, we can just keep polluting the Earth now, and in, you know, 100 years' time, if we haven't destroyed the Earth, we'll have been able to, you know, bootstrap technology to the point where we don't need all this pollution anymore, and we can fix this and fix that. You know, it felt like a comment by Alistair Reynolds on the way that we look at our Earth now. We think, well, we'd never do this to spaceships. We'd never just set off too quickly without the way to slow down again, but that's kind of what we do with world climate and technology and economics all the time. It's just like, well, just set off, let's go. But in a way, it felt a bit too strange. It felt a bit too, again, a bit forced. I think that would have been an interesting story to like say, or like to really get into the details of why everybody was so optimistic about this post-Chiabeza physics that they were going to exploit to slow down again. However, the book kind of relies on the fact that these spaceships, then they're like, ah, we have the problem of the slowdown. And it's the people of the slowdown. And lots of people are like, we're never going to slow down. Other people are like, well, we've got to work on this technology. But it turns out the technology is really dangerous. And one of these hollow ships in the caravan has already blown up once when they got that technology wrong. And so they're like, oh, okay, well, nobody's allowed to work on it anymore. It's like, but we speeded up this fast because we were going to work on this. So you've got the different drama and the different political factions on these things and different secret projects, secret research projects going on one ship, and other ships are going, well, I don't think we should slow down. We've got plenty of energy here. Let's just head off into the stars and just see where we end up. Let's see where we get taken. And other people are like, no, we're going to Crucible. We've got to slow down and get there at the other end. And that's where most of the drama comes from, or most of the conflict comes from in that thing. And while interesting in a way, it did feel a bit like, well, why did they do that in the first place? Why didn't they just accept that it's going to take them 250 years to get there instead of 120 years or 150 years to get there? Like, all of the important people who probably made that decision are going to just go into cold storage anyway. So, yeah. But it does provide the way that the plot can get along with big blocks of time. They're like, hey, we'll just put off this problem for 50 years. And it's like, really? Well, I guess that helps because we're going to tell this story at the speed of light, we're going to tell this story at the speed that it takes information to cross massive gaps at the speed of light. So it's good that some points they're like, hey, let's just put it off for a generation. Let's just put it off for 40 years and we'll get back to that problem then. And that's enough time for the memories to go back and forth. And there's like, right, okay, now let's start thinking about this. What's going to happen? That's kind of what the story is about. Thematically, it's not really about that so much. It feels to be much more about, like, you know, like, what is memory and what is truth and what is identity and all these big questions that science fiction always tackles. In this, I really enjoyed the exploration of the artificial intelligences. I don't want to spoil it too much, but you do have these different approaches. There's this one human brain derived artificial intelligence, which is very interesting. She is self-aware, but she doesn't understand, or she's self-aware of her limitations and self-aware of her, like, how little she is a human. She's always trying to become more human. And I really love the scenes where she's like, well, I'm now so random. I'm now too complex for me to know what I'm going to be thinking in 5 seconds' time. I used to always know what I was thinking, going to be thinking in 5 seconds' time, because I would just be able to know that because, you know, I'm this set. But now she's like, I don't know. I might fly this plane. I might crash it. I would never be able to crash a plane before, but now I might be able to crash this plane. So that's an interesting take on the artificial intelligence. But in the end, I felt these things were a bit wasted. They get to the alien planet at the end, and there's the watchkeepers there, who are they, like, the Uber artificial intelligences by the aliens, and they look at these Earth derived artificial intelligences that turn up, and the humans, and just go, oh, well, that's, you're not very impressive, are you? Well, they don't say that, but that's kind of the reaction. They're just ignored. It's just like, I guess it's like someone who is a professor at a university, and he's like, well, I'm studying physics and stuff. And then a little kid runs up and goes, hey, I've got a ball. When I drop the ball, it goes down because of gravity or something like that. And the kid's like, eh. And the professor just doesn't even respond, doesn't even react. That's the kind of view that I had of these different levels of intelligence, is that you sort of, if you encounter something so far below you, will you even bother acknowledging it? I'm not sure. Maybe. What else do I have to say? Let me go back to my notes here. Other characters. Oh, yeah. So talk about the characters. You do have Akinia. I really liked the interaction between the three Akinias and her interactions with other people. I really enjoy the fact that she has a husband in one place and a husband in another, or a love affair with this one person. And when she's after swapping memories, she says, hey, I can't remember the names of the different husbands, but she gets the names mixed up, and the husband on this side just looks at her going, hmm. She's like, oh, damn it, I got the husband's my other body, I'm in love with that other guy, not with this guy. No, but I am in love with this guy. And I quite like the different things. However, the people that Chico has to deal with on the ship, I was never really convinced about any of them, except for one called Travertine. And Travertine was a very interesting character. A scientist, someone who has, and it's weird for me to try and describe this person, because I want to say he is a scientist or she is a scientist. However, Alistair Reynolds brings in, and I mean, Juliana have talked about this a bit before when we're talking about the culture novels, how in the culture there is no gender specific personal pronoun. There's not he's or she's or it's or anything like that. It's gender non-specific, like Bert saying, when you say you, you're not saying you male or you female, it's just you. Or when you say I, it's not me male I, me female I, it's just I. And that goes all the way across. And Alistair Reynolds just decides that is this character going to be male or female, or should we just not distinguish between the two? So he introduces the personal pronouns of V. V did this, and this was given to Vim, or Ver, you know, just replacing the H at the CH at the start of he or she or his or hers, just replace that with a V, and that becomes a new gender non-specific personal pronoun. And what I liked most about this is that nobody in the story comments about it. It's just presumes that everybody in the story knows that there's some people who are either non-female and non-male, or in between, or not at all, or just don't want to be thought of as one or the other, or that's just an accepted part of the world that these people exist, and they just have a different personal pronoun, or they choose to use a different personal pronoun. And not only do the people in the book just presume this is every day, or how everything should be in every day, that Alistair Reynolds just presumes that we will, as readers, will just pick up on this and understand it. And it kind of is a really great comment on the world, that it's just presumed that it's like, well, why should this main character be male or female? And then when you actually look at it in that way, you realise that this book is quite unique in that it doesn't bring attention to all of the things that you would normally find in science fiction. Like, the main character isn't white, and the main character isn't male, and the main character isn't American or English, or even doesn't even speak English. When the characters are talking to each other, like, hey, do you know, like, Portuguese, and I speak Chinese, and this other person over here speaks Swahili. So those, of course, are going to be the languages that we talk to each other. And you realize this book, everything that everybody's saying, isn't in English. It's all in either Swahili or Portuguese or Hindi or these other, non-traditional languages for the future. Like, normally it's like, everyone's going to be speaking English is going to be the standard. But we're talking more of the BRIC countries. What are BRIC? That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, I guess, and then the African blocks of Africa as well, all speaking Swahili. And these are just now the languages of the future. But it's not commented on. It's like, oh, and in the future, everyone will be speaking this. No, it's just like halfway through the book, two characters are saying, do we have to switch to Portuguese? My Portuguese isn't very good. Can we not just stay here in Swahili? And it's quite refreshing to do that. Like, the main character isn't, you know, like I say, there's just no assumptions made about any of the identifiers that would normally be attached to a protagonist of a novel. And it's just not a deal. It's not a big deal made of anything. It's just presumed that we are totally happy with everyone speaking Swahili in the future. Got that? Great. Which is good. Yes, so travertine. So, yeah, just going through these notes here. I said, heading to the stars, bring elephants, bring dolphins, yep. So, yeah, there are some really good set pieces in this. They actually go to the people from Earth, Chico Green or Yellow on Earth. She's home to her husband and says, ah, I have to go to Venus. He's like, oh, man, I don't really enjoy Italy very much. And she's like, no, not Venice, Venus. He's like, yes, I know, I was joking. So they take a trip to Venus, which is good fun, and there's some good action there. And then they also go to Saturn, and there's a burial in Saturn, which I really enjoyed, because if you put someone outside, they freeze, and then you explode them outside, and then they go and join the rings of Saturn. There's bits of ice crystals, and they get spread out through the rings of Saturn, which is, again, a very nice image. And this book is full of really cool images and really cool scenes and really cool bits of action in the first half. In the second half, there's other bits of action and other cool scenes, but they get spread out and spread out more, and more of the time is just like killing time. It feels like just killing time between this. And then there's a big, great thing at the end where the elephants come out in the hollow ship, and they help with this uprising of the people to throw off the tyranny, and it's all, yay, it's going to be great. And not just the people, like I say, the elephants and the uplifted elephants, they all band together. It's like, yeah, and they come out and they kick ass and they take over and it's going to be great. But we don't see any of that because we stick so closely with Chico Red and Chico Yellow and Chico Green that at that point, Chico isn't on the ship. She's elsewhere. And then, you know, the message is sent across to her. And I'm like, but okay, you're sticking with this idea where the memories have to go. And I really wish we could have seen that firsthand, instead of her just getting a memory of it and getting... Well, it's not even that she gets a memory that she lives at firsthand, because she wasn't there, so she can't just get it from another one of her clones. But in a way, I would have really appreciated it if, like, at that point in the book, like near the end of the book, Chico Green or Chico Yellow... Chico Green, who is on the hollow ship, could have said, well, it's really important for me to stay here and look after this place, but it's also very important for me to leave this place and do this other thing. So let me now split apart myself again. And in that way, Alistair Reynolds could have kept up the thing of having one character in two different places. So this same character could have become important in both places yet again, rather than just being important in one place or in three places. Could be important in four places, and just go with that. Like, take that idea of one person being able to be in multiple places, rather than the idea of the viewpoint being restricted to the same character in three different places. Like, I was going to say this, I thought there was a way through which stuck to one storytelling idea over the other storytelling idea, and he had kind of two ways to go in that direction. So if he was ever to rewrite this book, that's what I would suggest, and get the climax to both stories told from the point of view of two Chicos, rather than the climax of one story being told via a third person. What else? Another note that I have here. In my updates that I posted to Goodreads. Oh no, these are my other notes as well. It just says that, like, I put my up to halfway through, action, 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 and stop. And the note is, then I wrote a note, a long time since any happy or enthusiastic notes, and then way too long to get to things now. Those are my only two notes from the whole of the second half of the book. A long time since any happy or enthusiastic notes. And I just want more. I just wanted, like, again, I understand the structure. But it did leave me, like, appreciating the novel for the things that Alistair Reynolds was trying to do, rather than actually enjoying the final outcome as itself. So let me bring this on to the... let me talk about the... I'll open the Audible page, which I've got right here. So this is... I listened to this as an audiobook. It's 23 hours and 10 minutes long. Should have been about 15 hours, I reckon. It's narrated by Ajoa Ando, a female narrator. Obviously... of some kind of, like, Ajoa Ado Ando, not quite sure where she's from, but obviously from somewhere African, I'm guessing. I looked at some of her other books that she's narrated. Let me just click on this link again so it comes through. And she narrates book things like Ghana Must Go, The Minor Adjustment Beauty Salon, you know, the number one ladies detective agency, which is a you know, one that's set in Nigeria or something. I can't remember. The White Giraffe, The Safari Club, The Double Comfort Safari Club. So in other words, if there's a book which has any connection with Africa, it seemed like she, Tears of the Giraffe. All this kind of stuff. You're thinking, well, she's going to get the she's going to get any Africa connected book that comes up. And which is great because she does the accents really well. And I say, oh, you wouldn't have known that they're talking Swahili. But obviously, that's all the characters have some kind of accent, which is, I guess, non-distinct African for the most part. I know that Africa is such a big place, and it's kind of a bit. What would you say? Like a bit racist, and for me not to just say, oh, non-specific Africa, oh, just over there somewhere. But I travelled around Africa for 5 weeks last year, or 2 years ago now, and I wouldn't be able to specifically point out where any of the accents come from. I was like, oh, this sounds very like a South African person. And of course it wasn't. They were from Zimbabwe. And because when you go further south in Africa, the people start sounding different, but otherwise I wouldn't be able to tell. So anyway, a very good narrator. No big thumbs up or thumbs down, just did a good job. If you want this book for free, I would say don't listen to this book. Try out a different Alistair Reynolds book first, because this one is, like I say, minor Alistair Reynolds. If you want these same ideas, check out House of Suns, Terminal Earth, Chasm City, Terminal World, Chasm City, and others before you get to this. This is, I would say, for Alistair Reynolds completists, as I am, I guess. A few short stories of his I've not read, but otherwise up to date with all of his novels. So when a new one comes out, why wouldn't I read it? I'm actually, though, looking forward to the next book in this series, because this does kind of finish on a downbeat. It feels like, oh, it's middle trilogy, you know, you always have the ending on a bit of a low at the end of the second novel. And this doesn't end so much on a low, but it feels like it's just slowed down a bit to that point where you think, oh, now it's going to start ramping up again. But now I've got to wait like a year before I read the next book in the series, which I don't mind. Hopefully it's a step up again and everything is answered, everything's wrapped up. But then sometimes I like a bit more ambiguous endings. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. Right then. What was I saying? Audible. You can get an Audible trial. You can get any ebook for free from Audible if you want. Just go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And in doing so, you get to benefit from this. And also I get to benefit because I get a bit of money for everyone who goes there. There's not just this book or not just science fiction. There's now 150,000 audiobooks that you can check out there. And, which is really cool, me and Juliana were talking about, we're going to get to, in our culture read-along series that we're doing by Ian and Banks, and I was complaining that they didn't have the use of weapons as a Peter Kenny ebook here on Audible, or not in my in Germany where I can get it. So I had another one, but the State of the Art is coming out on the 27th of January, or the 23rd of January, I can't remember exactly when it is, but that's coming out as a Peter Kenny read audiobook. So I've already pre-ordered that, and hopefully that'll be in a few weeks' time, when I'm back from my next work trip, Juliana and I will continue on that way. Let's get back to this one. I'll wrap up this review by giving it, I was going to say like 3 stars, maybe 2.5, 3 stars. I think I'll probably give it 3 stars because there is a lot of stuff that is good in this book, but it is remarkably average in the way that it starts off so strong and ends so slow. It doesn't end disappointing, but it just ends in a way on such a down at the end, like, in terms of, you know, the pacing and action and things. I just really wanted, you know, just to, I don't want it to be always on the edge of my seat, but I think that this could have been compressed a lot, and I just wish it had been like, say 23 hours and 10 minutes, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 hours would have made this a lot tighter, a lot better, or at least a lot more enjoyable. Anyway, that's it about this book. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Roche there. You can become my friend on Goodreads. And in that way, I can see what you think of the books that I'm reading, and you can recommend books there. For example, Saku rated this 3 stars. Tom rated it 4 stars. Christopher Murphy, these are all SFBRP listeners, rated it 5 stars. Who else? Tudor rated it 5 stars as well. So, Friends reviews on average, 4.25. But I think it's a bit lower than that. I'll give it 3 stars. Otherwise, you can follow me on my blog. I'm at lukeburridge.com /blog, and you can read my fiction there as well, and lukeburridge.com, and you can click the link that says original fiction, which you can check out there and read my own stuff if you want. Or finally, you can email me at luke@juggler.net is the way that you can get in contact with me, and I reply to every email. So if you want something which is about anything really, I just, like I say, I reply to everything, every message, every question that comes through, I'll get back to at some point. So I think that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.